Let's start with our motivation. And so to remember that while we meditate on emptiness, especially when we're doing deity yoga practice, then to remember when we come out of that, we imagine ourselves as the deity, that compassion has got to be our motivation. So to really make sure we put that into our practice, we meditate on emptiness, and then we don't just, stop and open our eyes and say, what's for lunch? But we say, okay, I was clearing away obstacles in my mind through the meditation on emptiness. And now, out of compassion, I'm going to, engage with the conventional world and use my senses once more. But my motivation for doing this is not attachment to sensory pleasure, but it's really out of compassion. And so everything I do now that I've finished my meditation on emptiness, everything I do may be motivated by compassion. And so, throughout the day, well, this is at the end of our meditations on emptiness, but then throughout the day, to keep coming back to that and to keep putting the focus of our attention on the welfare of all sentient beings. Yeah, so that doesn't mean ignoring our own self, but it means not spinning around the self. Yeah, so our focus is on the benefit of all beings, and especially those close to us who can we can influence the most in a positive direction. And keep reminding ourselves of that. And then when we see ourselves just spinning around I and my problems and what's happening to me and my life and these people do this to me and I want and all that kind of stuff, just to realize, hey, wait a minute, that isn't in accord with my motivation. And, I have a really heartfelt, sincere motivation to have compassion for all living beings, and I'm trying to put my energy into that. But when I lose my mindfulness of that and the old habits come back, then I'm completely working at cross purposes to what's really in my heart. And so, without getting mad at ourselves or anything like that, just noticing that. And, okay, I fell in the booby trap of self-centeredness, and now I'm putting myself back on track and I'm going on. Yeah. Because as much as we can really see the faults of that self-centeredness and the benefits of cherishing others and put our mindfulness on the benefit, the benefit of others, then the happier we're going to be by far, and the more meaningful our life will become. Because as we all know, that spinning around the self is very painful. So as we listen to the Gumchen Rim teachings tonight, let's keep that in mind. I was thinking, because we all go through hard times at different points in our practice and at different points in our life. And when you're going through a hard time, at least, when I look all the times when I've lived a number of years and have had a whole chronology of hard times. In each one of them, my mind has been going like this around me, I, my, and mine. If I look at the uniform characteristic of all my hard times and all my crises, the thing that is in common with all of them is just, oh, this happened to me, and I'm so confused, and I don't know what to do, and these people don't appreciate me, and what am I going to do, and how's this, and this is that, and I'm so angry, and me. You know, it's amazing. Because we usually think, you know, my hard times and my crises, it's because the outer circumstance, you know, is horrible. Yeah. But when I really look, it's the inner circumstance that is horrible, not the outer one so much. Yeah? Yeah? Okay, things may have happened on the outside, but it's my mind that makes those into problems. They aren't problems in and of themselves. My mind makes them into a problem, you know? And how does my mind make them into a problem? It's by putting this big me in the middle and then making everything in the environment clash with me. You know? There's the environment just like that. I put me in, and they're standing there, and that's ridiculous. But it's me making all those things into a problem. You know? Because, you know, a lot of times the other people in the situation, they don't see things as a problem. Yeah. And they see what they're doing as, you know, fine. And it's my mind that says, no, it's not fine. And you're doing this to me, and I'm unhappy, and I need to feel heard. And yeah, it's very interesting when you look at it, because we're so sure that problem is out there. But it's really our mind that makes it a problem. You know, like when somebody criticizes us. Yeah, somebody trashes us. It seems like, well, that's the problem, and that's the pain, and that's the unhappiness, and it's all out there, and then it's coming here and hitting me and affecting me and making me miserable. But when you really think about it, it's just words that somebody's saying. Yeah, and it's just sound waves. And it's my mind that makes those sound waves become a problem. It's interesting, isn't it? You're all looking kind of shocked and horrified. Like I just told you there was a ghost or something. But when you think about it, isn't it like that? You know, our mind makes that into a problem. You know, like you read this email and you go, oh, why is the person writing me about this? And it's like, it's just a screen with squiggles on it. What's making a screen with squiggles on it into a problem? Yeah? What's making that into a problem? If the squiggles formed letters in Arabic or Russian, I wouldn't look at it and say it's a problem, because I wouldn't understand. They would just be squiggles. But if those squiggles are in Roman letters and form English words, then it becomes a problem. Yeah. So where's the problem? I mean, what's making it a problem? It's my mind, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, what Shantideva says about the, you know, the afflictions being our real enemy, it's so true, isn't it? Yeah, so true. Now, if we could only remember it, next time we get an email that we don't like, or next time we hear sounds that we don't like, you know, or next, how about just take away the don't like part them, because it's also our mind that makes it not likable, you know, to take away that part and just, you know, okay, I don't need to make this into a problem. I don't need to make this situation all about me. But it is all about me. Because I'm sure this person really meant da, 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 da. And you see what they said behind that is this and this and this. And then we psychoanalyze them. Yes. The therapist in the house, don't you love when we psychoanalyze people? And then we check our diagnosis with you, and you better agree with ours. What do you mean, no comment? Are you insinuating that my diagnoses are wrong? No comments. Wait a minute. Oh, this is really bad. Okay, so I wanted to... I got this request from Venerable Tenpa, and you know, one of our Russian monks, and to write something to Kuan Yin after the tragedy that happened in Siberia with 64 people, many of them kids, getting burnt in the mall. So I put something together. This is particularly my talent. So I want to read it to you and get your comments, and we can kind of write it together, you know? Okay, so it's called Sorrow and Hope, A Prayer to Kuan Yin. So Kuan Yin, you who hears the cries of the world, please listen to our outpouring of sorrow and hope. Just as when frightened, children seek protection and refuge in their mother's comforting arms, so do we children of the Dharma seek protection and refuge from you when saddened and horrified by the suffering of samsara. But who are you? You are nothing other than wisdom and compassion, the wisdom and compassion of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and our own latent wisdom and compassion that can grow to become like yours. In tragedy, may we turn to wisdom and compassion and be comforted by its protective embrace. Seeing that all beings seek only happiness and never misery, may we abandon despair, anger, and blame. May all those who suffer from loss and grief, from horror and outrage, become fountains of wisdom and compassion flowing out to the world and healing beings' pain. May all those who have died in avoidable tragedies release all attachment to this life and go on to the next with their hearts full of wisdom and compassion. And with love, may we send them on with prayers that they be born in your pure land. By holding ourselves and others responsible for our misdeeds, with compassion, may all of us overcome the self-centered attitude and create a better world, one in which everyone seeks to benefit each other. Are there ways that you would edit it and change words or... No.
I would say take refuge in you rather than from you.
From you. Yeah, I was wondering about that when I read it.
The only thing I can think of is often used, I love it by the way, we use the phrase wisdom and compassion. I wonder if in some places you might want to use words that have the same meaning, a change.
Yeah.
The number of times you use that phrase.
Yeah, it's quite common. What else can we put?
I like the repetition, another point of view. Mm-hmm. It adds, for me, it adds a kind of like a litany. It sort of becomes a rhythmic litany of these are our resources, these are our refuge, these are our resources, these are our refuge. So it's a different point of view of the same. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't find it distracting, by the way.
It builds momentum.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That kind of repetition builds momentum.
Mm-hmm.
I did wonder if somewhere towards the end, since you referred to her as she who hears the cries of the world, coming back to that phrase again, with something like a hope at the end. You who hear the cries of the world, may we
too hear the cries of the world.
May we too
yeah.
Hear the cries and offer the same nectar.
By holding ourselves and others responsible for our misdeeds, may we too hear the cries of the world.
Actually, that question I had a question about. Holding ourselves and others responsible for our misdeeds?
Meaning our collective misdeeds. Uh-huh. Yeah.
We want to do something, though. May we hear the cries of the world and
transform
or turn toward them with,
Well, the next sentence is, and with compassion may all of us overcome the self-centered attitude and create a better world. That's the following sentence, one in which everyone seeks to benefit each other. Yeah, is that okay?
Because the wisdom and compassion addresses the horror, addresses the blame, addresses the rage. I mean, it's given to an alternative on all the kinds of responses and emotions that may have occurred due to this tragedy.
Yeah.
So you can insert it into whatever mind you have, mm-hmm. and it's the gift of it.
Yeah.
Suggesting mentioning her other forms.
That what?
Her other incarnations.
You mean like Chandrasekhar?
What about them? Mentioning the other?
Yeah, someone suggested maybe mentioning the other forms
of Kuan Yin. Of Kuan Yin.
Or female Buddhas. Mm-hmm. That's just their suggestion.
Okay. Yeah, they asked for something specifically to Kuan Yin. They didn't say Chenrezig, which I found interesting. They specifically said Kuan Yin. Okay, so now we'll go on to the topic that I didn't prepare for tonight. It's okay.
Can you send it around to us? Again.
I'll read the Gomchen Lamrim part, and then I will find the section. Okay, so we're talking about, last time we were talking about illusion-like appearances. Okay, so now we're at the heading, explaining the reasoning of dependent arising. Okay, so moreover, results not produced in reliance on causes and things with parts not reliant on their parts do not exist. Okay, so things that are independent, that functioning things that do not arise due to causes and conditions, such things don't exist. And things that have parts but do not exist by relying on their parts, those things also don't exist. By analyzing what arises in dependence and what is named independence, as being inherently one with or distinct from what they depend on, refute true existence. That sentence doesn't make a lot of sense. Yeah. I think, where are you? Yes. For your thing with Bill, to retranslate this text.
Yeah. There's other texts already. He's looking at
them. Oh.
The Shamar Lamrim.
Oh, okay. But this is good practice for that because Shamar Lamrim has, they're both good texts, yeah. Either one are okay. I think what this sentence actually means is, okay, if you take things that arise and exist independence and you think that they're inherently existent, then to overcome that wrong view, you analyze whether they're inherently one with or distinct from what they depend on. In other words, their parts. Yeah? Or to put it another way, can the object exist independent from its basis of designation? So we have the designated object and the basis of designation, and are they two independent things, or do they exist in dependence on each other? Because sometimes we get the object and the basis of designation very confused. Yeah, because we look at this and, the basis of designation is the clay formed into a certain shape and the lid and all of that stuff. That's the basis of designation. And we're the ones who impute cup on top of it. Yeah, but when we look at it, we don't think there's a basis of designation and we're imputing cup. We think cup. This is a cup. We don't think this is called a cup. Yeah. I used to wonder sometimes when my teachers would teach, they would say, such and such is called this and that. And I would think, why don't they just say such and such is that? And I think, because it's reminding, no, it's called that. It is not that. The basis of designation is not the designated object. Okay? So like our basis of designation is our body and mind. Yeah? Are our body and mind us? Is the collection of body and mind us? Yeah? But when you look at somebody, yeah, when I look out there at you, I don't think bodies and minds. I think people. But actually, there's bodies and minds. And people are what are designated in dependence upon those, the different combinations of body and mind. Yeah. And when you say me, yeah, it feels like there's a separate person in there. Yeah, something that's really, yeah, there's a real me, a unique personality who has interests and needs and special creativity abilities and whatever it is. We feel there's this person that there. But all there is a body and mind, and the person is designated in dependence on that. And aside from the body and mind, there's no, and the body and mind and the designation, there's no person there. Yeah, there's the appearance of a person. Yeah. Or we could say there is a person there, but that person is not findable when you look for it. Yeah, but sometimes it's easier to go, but wait, there's no person there, because our idea of person is some unique personality there that's different and special than the rest of us. And it's rather shocking, isn't it? I mean, isn't it shocking to think, but I'm not a unique individual? I'm not a real person. Yeah? Because all of our thoughts all day long is, me and my role and what I can contribute, how people think of me, and I have this unique personality and unique karma and unique ability and can do so much and this and that. I mean, there's really a person there. That's how it feels, isn't it? Yeah, but there's just a body and mind. Then you go, no, there's a person. But what person are you going to point to? Well, there's somebody with that unique potential and those unique abilities. Well, what are those unique abilities? Yeah, mostly they're combinations of mental factors. Yeah, well, I have a unique creative ability. You just have a certain combination of mental factors that arise now and then. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because we think so highly of ourselves, don't we? But when you look there, you know, or you think, I'm a tremendous athlete, you know, all there are, you know, arms and legs and, you know, and a liver that you're throwing over this hot bar. You know, I'm an Olympic high jumper. Look at me. And, you know, all you're doing is throwing arms and limbs and a liver and a kidney over a bar. Yeah, I mean, really, that's all it is, isn't it? And you think, I won an Olympic medal for the high jump. You know, like there's a real person who jumped over that bar. Yeah. So it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah? Because, yes, you know, things are more than the sum of their parts, but that's just a dependent arising. But we don't see it as a dependent arising. We think there is something there that is pointable and isolatable that, you know, that we can say is the Olympic athlete, that we can say is the talented musician, that we can say is the, you know, intellectual nun, or, you know, whatever it is. Okay? But it's just a bunch of mental factors and, you know, arms and legs and kidneys and skin and, you know, like when you do the mindfulness of the body, yeah? Head, hair, body, hair, nail, teeth, skin. Then what?
Last muscle, one. Sinew, bone.
Muscle, sinew,
muscle, sinew,
bone.
Bone.
Something. And then kidney is the last one.
Marrow,
kidney. Yeah. You know? I mean, that's all that there is there. That's all. But there's this precious, special body that, you know, yeah, a bunch of vegetable goo, that's all. Isn't it? Is it any more than vegetable goo? Maybe meat goo if you're not a vegetarian. You have recycled other people's body sitting on this chair. If you eat meat, that's what it is, isn't it? Recycled cows and chickens and fish's bodies sitting on that chair. Yeah. We're vegetarian. We're recycled broccoli and, you know, grass and lettuce and carrots. And, you know, that's all that's sitting on this chair, you know, a pile of carrots. Mixed in with tofu, you know, some dairy, or maybe some people don't have dairy mixed in. That's all that's sitting, you know, on the cushion right here. No, there's me. There's me. This special, unique, you know, God sent to the world. Me!
Well, there was a story in the New York Times about Michael Phelps, who has a record for his Olympic medals, about his depression that he experiences after every Olympic meet and how he has really had a death wish on many occasions.
Yeah.
And now, deep depression. And now many athletes are talking about this Olympian high and then the Olympian low that comes. Wow. For this very reason, grasping at a unique self. I mean, you don't have to be an Olympian to do that, but
yeah, because you did so much, and then you know you can never do it again, and you also know that you did it, and so what? You know, I swam the fastest mile. I ran the fastest mile. Yeah, so
you're still getting old, sick, and dying.
Yeah. I gave this great Dharma teaching. Yeah, aren't I wonderful? So? Yeah, why are you so great for that? Other people have been kind to you. Why are you so special for doing something for them? You know, anyway, who's the one? It's just a bunch of mental factors and a mouth. Yeah? Yeah, teeth and tongue and mouth and mixing the mental factors. And yeah, because and anything, anyway, everything we're saying we heard from other people. Nothing at all of it is ours. Yeah, it's all from other people. Yeah, so I gave this nice talk. Yeah, right? So? Yeah. You said what the Buddha said. It wasn't your thing. Yeah. And a bunch of mental factors in this mouth and tongue, you know. Blah, blah. So? Okay, so interesting, you know, when we start getting hung up on ourselves. Yeah. Or when we get to the thing of, you know, I can't do that, that's too hard. Yeah, it's just a bunch of mental factors. Or, I don't want to do this. She wants me to shovel snow. I don't want to shovel snow. Yeah. She wants me to work in the forest. I hate working in the forest. You know, there you have, you know, your tongue and your lips and the teeth, again, you know, this mouth. You know, just visualize it. It's just this mouth in space. And then a bunch of mental factors that say, I don't like working in the forest. I don't want a vacuum. I don't want to... That's all. Just those mental factors that happen to arise at that particular time. There could have been other mental factors that arose.
I don't want to hear you. I don't want to hear you.
Yeah. Quite interesting. Now, how we take it and we construct this whole incredible world. And give so many things meaning and create systems, you know. Like I think our whole economic system is something created by human beings' minds, and then we suffer due to it. Yeah? We created the stock market. Human beings' minds created the stock market, and then we suffer because the stock market goes down. But we're the ones who created the stock market. Yeah? It's weird, isn't it? Yeah? I mean, we created money too, and then we get upset when we don't have a lot of it. And actually, hardly anybody has money nowadays. They usually just have, you know, pieces of plastic, or they have numbers on a screen, more squiggles on a screen, you know? And I think that's amazing. You know, you want to buy something and you just change the squiggles on your screen and somebody else changes the squiggles on their screen. And then you take home something that's really useful. Or not. Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? So how to establish the lack of inherent existence of, oh, okay, well, we'll do this quickly and then we'll go back to the functional things, okay? But how to establish the lack of inherent existence of non-composite phenomena as well by means of this and former reasons, okay? So this is talk, before we've been analyzing functional things, impermanent things. And so, remember last night we were talking about the ways to divide existence. And so, one way is impermanent and permanent, or composite phenomena, non-composite phenomena. Yeah, produce phenomena unproduced, or non-produced, unproduced. Okay, so yeah, so we have to take care of those things too, you know, the permanent things. So it says, therefore, cessation, space, nirvana, and such. Okay, what's an example of something else besides cessation, space, and nirvana? That's a permanent phenomena.
Emptiness.
Okay. Okay. What?
Generic image.
That one, oh, we've been trying to understand that for a while. Yeah?
Lack of the thing. Because when you conceptualize something, you're...
Yeah.
And they get everything that is not it.
It's not it. Yeah. We've had this discussion with Jeffrey, remember? Because there was some place we found in one of the books where it was saying that generic images are impermanent. Yeah? It was very confusing. Maybe we'll figure it out. Yeah, because I had always heard before that they were permanent. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, because I remember Jeffrey saying they were impermanent.
Yeah, he doesn't... remember what he said.
He was talking how it's generally taught that they're permanent, but he never has quite agreed with that because in his mind, when he looks at something, it does change.
Oh, no, that's when we were talking about conceptual appearances or meaning generalities.
Oh, okay.
That's what he said about those. But those are things that are usually said to be permanent, too.
What were you speaking of then?
Huh?
Generic image. Isn't that the same as a meaning generality?
A generic image? Oh, I guess, yeah. I was thinking of... No, what they say... Oh, I was thinking of generally characterized phenomena.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah, generic image, right.
Yeah. It's usually held as permanent.
Yeah, it's usually held as permanent, but both he and I are skeptical. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So if, so cessation, space, nirvana, and such are positive respectively as to be attained, known, and as an object of refuge. So nirvana, cessation to be attained, space to be known, and nirvana as an object of refuge. If they existed inherently, this could not be because you couldn't have any action in relation to these things if they inherently existed. Mm. Because things that are inherently existent don't have any relationship with anything else. Conventionally, they are classified as definitions and definiendum. But those examples are all definiendums. They say definienda. I don't know what the plural of definiendum is. Definiendums.
I think definienda is the plural of
Yeah, but you know, with continuum, the plural is not necessarily continua. It can also be continuums. So, yeah, maybe look it up, somebody.
My experience says it is the plural definienda.
Does it say, what happens if you put definiendums? Does it reject it? Because that's what I did with continuums. And it came up and it said, oh, you know, either one of those. Yeah. Both of them are okay.
It's plural in this context because definitions is also plural.
Yeah, but I'm just talking about how you spell the plural. We all agree that it's plural, but I'm just talking about how we spell it. Okay, is it definienda or definiendums? Because we don't say definition we say definitions.
No Google results.
Uh huh. Yes.
Definiendums, but definienda, yes, there's a lot.
Okay, but it doesn't have. Are there some with an S?
No.
Just the one with an A. Okay.
Three M's. She was looking for Definium, D-U-M-S. Definium with the S on the end.
Yeah.
Doesn't exist.
Yeah, or she didn't find it, but she did find Definienda.
Yes.
Okay.
Lots of references.
Just once?
No, many times.
Many times, okay. Okay. So that's good. Otherwise, they would be unrelated, or all would be both definitions and Definienda. If you affirm they are related, that dissipates their true existence, okay, because... Again, if things are truly existent, they're self-enclosed, they exist independent, so they wouldn't even have a definition, because having a definition means that you're related to something. Yeah? Okay. It would mean there's no basis, you know, if nirvana were inherently existent, there would be no basis independence upon which we designated nirvana, there would just be nirvana. Yeah. I was thinking about that this afternoon because I was I'd gone on to the next chapter about conventional and ultimate truths, and I was thinking, you know, in the early days when the translation terms were sometimes a bit hit and miss. Like wrong views was translated as heresy. That was a good one. Yeah. And actually, one of my teachers still says heresy because that's what he looked up in the dictionary when he was maybe 18 years old learning English. Anyway, the terms for the two truths were often relative and absolute. You know? And I was thinking, that's translating it that way is so misleading because then you think nirvana, true cessation, space, all these things, they're absolute truths. And absolute, the English word absolute, really implies not related to anything else, doesn't it? An absolute truth is there, independent, unchanging there, waiting for us to discover it. But something can't be independent and still be something that we can discover. Yeah? I mean, if it's a knowable object, then it's going to be known, which means it has a relationship with a knower. Okay? So I was thinking just how misleading some of the translation terms were. You know, and then we saw... you know, instead of conventional truth or veiled truth or whatever, we would say relative truth. Yeah? Like it's all relative. Well, in one way, yes, it is all relative. But we often say it's all relative to mean anything goes and that you don't have to hold any standard to anything because it's all relative. So that can be a bit misleading too. Anyway, so I think ultimate truth is a much better thing. So we don't think of emptiness, because it's very easy to think of emptiness as some absolute thing, isn't it? You know, because it's there, it's permanent, it pervades everything, it's the nature of everything. You can't touch it, you can't see it, you know? It's uncreated. So, it must be absolute. Doesn't have any relationship to anything. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And then we think, realize emptiness as if, you know, you have to go to some other planet to realize emptiness. And I remember Lama Yeshe. I have such a vivid image in my mind of Lama Yeshe sitting on the throne in the old Kopan Gompa, you know, and just saying, emptiness is right here, right now, dear. It isn't in some faraway place. It's right here, now. You don't have to go anywhere to find it. Yeah, he was quite adamant.
You can see why.
Yeah.
Generation at that time.
Yeah. Okay. With the reasoning called one or distinct two, the parts of non-composite things and the possessor of parts are to be analyzed as either inherently one or distinct. Okay, so that's saying that non-composite permanent things also are composed of parts. So then, like with permanent things or impermanent things that are composed with parts, you analyze whether the object and the parts are inherently one or inherently different. And this reason easily establishes their lack of inherent existence as well. So what are the parts of emptiness? We say emptiness is dependent on parts. What are its parts?
The emptiness of the cup, the emptiness of the gong, the emptiness of the laptop.
Yeah. So if we're talking about emptiness as a general category, then it's the emptiness of all the different phenomena. Okay. Then what else is emptiness dependent on? The mind that designates. And what else?
The basis.
Yeah, the basis of designation. And what else? What's the real big thing that emptiness is dependent upon?
The mind that apprehends it.
Not only that.
Being empty.
Not only that.
Conventional.
It's dependent on conventional phenomena. Mm-hmm. Conventional phenomena are the base in which we look and find emptiness. Without conventional phenomena, there couldn't be emptiness. Okay? So again, I think that's one of the big things Lama was trying to get at when he said, emptiness is right here, right now. In other words, you are a conventional phenomena. You're surrounded by conventional phenomena. All of them are empty of inherent existence. All of them have emptiness as their ultimate nature. Yeah, it's right here together with the very phenomena that we're perceiving with our senses. Except we don't see it.
Is there as many emptiness as there are conventional?
Mm-hmm.
So is it an equal amount?
Yeah.
One more. The emptiness of emptiness.
Yeah, there's probably actually more emptinesses because you do have, the emptiness of emptiness, the emptiness of the emptiness of the cup. Yeah, because there's many more permanent phenomena there than there are impermanent phenomena.
Yeah. And the emptiness of the cup is also a conventional phenomenon.
No, the emptiness of the cup is an ultimate truth, but it exists conventionally.
Right, it's a conventional phenomenon.
It's not I'm using conventional phenomena as
conventional truth?
It's conventionally existent. It's conventionally existent, but yes. It's not a conventional truth, so it's not a conventional phenomena. But it exists conventionally. Okay, emptiness exists conventionally. Why? Because conventional existence is the only kind of existence there is. There's no such a thing as ultimate existence. There's nothing that is ultimately existent. Except maybe rabbit's horns. Because you can say anything you want about rabbit's horns. Yeah, because they don't exist. You can say anything you want. Well, should we just say that's enough on the emptiness of phenomena? We could go into a whole lot of other things, but we can. You want to talk a little? Should we talk a little bit about the verses that we chant a lot from Three Principal Aspects of the Path? Yeah. Okay. So I'll read a lot from here because I didn't read it earlier. So, okay, so so the first verse is, one who sees the infallible cause and effect of all phenomena in cyclic existence and beyond and destroys all false perceptions of their inherent existence has entered the path that pleases the Buddha. Okay, so here you're, it's interesting because you're talking about infallible cause and effect of all phenomena in cyclic existence and beyond. But the beyond refers to nirvana, and nirvana is permanent. So you could say, what's it doing talking about the cause and effect of nirvana? Okay, maybe I'll just read a bit. Okay, here he sets out the sequence in how to come to understand emptiness. To understand emptiness and to have a complete understanding of the correct view are not the same. That's interesting, because you would think they would be the same, wouldn't you? To understand emptiness and to have a complete understanding of the correct view are not the same. You can have an understanding of emptiness, but without having a complete understanding of the correct view. To have a full understanding of emptiness, such that the analysis of the profound view is complete, we must understand emptiness in terms of dependent designation. Realizing emptiness in terms of dependent designation occurs subsequent to the initial realization of emptiness and is not required to realize emptiness initially. And actually, our initial realization of emptiness is an inferential one. Yeah? And that one's the correct view. But it's not a full understanding of emptiness. However, if our understanding of emptiness does not support or does not complement our understanding of dependent arising, it is not complete. Yeah? So we always hear about emptiness and dependent arising coming to the same point, but just because you realize emptiness doesn't mean you've realized dependent arising. Yeah? Or at least not, you haven't realized the full meaning of dependent arising. That comes after direct realization of emptiness. Okay, so then the verse, the one who sees the infallible cause and effect, that verse. In this verse, infallible cause and effect of all phenomena in cyclic existence and beyond refers to all phenomena, both products, impermanent phenomena, and non-products, or permanent phenomena. Beyond refers to nirvana, the state beyond sorrow and misery of samsara. Nirvana is a permanent phenomena, so literally cause and effect do not apply to it. Did you ever think of that when you were chanting the verse? Yeah. So, however, we can say that the true cessation comes into being dependent on causes, but is not produced by causes as such. We can also say that emptiness is the quote-quote cause of Arya's qualities, because realizing emptiness makes one an Arya. Okay, so what it's saying here is we can use the word cause in different ways here, okay? True, first of all, true sensation is permanent, okay? So it's not produced. It doesn't depend on causes and conditions, yeah? But it does come into being dependent on causes, because we have to meditate on the path in order to attain a true cessation. So our meditation on the path is not a cause for true cessation, because true cessation or nirvana doesn't have a cause. Yeah. But the true cessation in my mental continuum comes into being dependent on my following the path. And following the path is a cause. Okay? So this is interesting, isn't it? So in other words, come into being does not mean the same thing as produce. Okay? Something can come into being without it being produced. Like the cup, yeah? Before the cup was made, there was no emptiness of the cup. It isn't that the emptiness of the cup has existed since beginningless time. It can't, because the cup hasn't existed since beginningless time. But when the cup comes into existence, its emptiness also comes into existence, but nothing produced that emptiness. Okay? So that's one point here. Yeah. And then we can also say that emptiness is the cause, in quotation marks, is the cause of Arya's qualities, because realizing emptiness makes one an Arya. So, of course, emptiness is not the cause of Arya's qualities, because Arya's qualities are impermanent phenomena. Emptiness isn't. It can't cause anything. But because Arya's qualities depend on emptiness being the object of an Arya consciousness perceiving it, because of that, then you can impute the word cause and say emptiness is a cause of the Arya's qualities, even though it isn't. Okay? And so what it's getting at here is, I mean, with conventional words, you can say anything you want as long as you explain them so they make sense. Okay? So we can say, yeah, emptiness is the cause of Arya's qualities. Doesn't mean that emptiness was like the seed that transformed into Arya's qualities. Not at all. But it's because in dependence on realizing emptiness that then the Arya's qualities came about. So in that respect, we call it a cause, but it's not a cause. Yeah, just remember that we say we planted a tree when we planted a seed. Yeah? Yeah. Well, we always say, oh, I planted that tree. Yeah, does anybody say, you're a liar, you didn't plant that tree? You planted a seed. Nobody says that. Everybody knows what that person means. But literally, it's not true, is it? Yeah. We don't plant seeds. We don't plant whole trees. We tried to move some trees, remember? Yeah, those beautiful tamaracks. We tried to move them. We tried to plant them.
Heartbreak.
Yeah. Didn't work. So then we could say, I planted a tree. But normally, we plant seeds or we plant seedlings or something like that. Okay. In a broader way, cause and effect in this verse refers to more than causal dependence. See, usually cause and effect, you know, when we talk about the different kinds of dependent arising, cause and effect usually refers to causal dependence. But here it's saying it refers to more than that. And it includes mutual dependence and dependent designation, which apply to all phenomena, including nirvana. Okay? Because causal dependence applies only to impermanent things. Yeah? Mutual dependence and dependent designation apply also to permanent phenomena. Then in the verse, the path that pleases the Buddha refers to the inferential realization of emptiness. Yeah. Beginning from the time when we have even a doubt inclined towards the correct meaning, in this case thinking maybe phenomena are empty, from that time we are in the process of entering the path pleasing the Buddha. Oh, that's nice to think, isn't it? We're in the process of entering the path that pleases the Buddha. Okay, we have entered that path and found the correct view when we gain an infallible, inferential understanding of emptiness. However, we have not yet completed our analysis of the correct view because we are not yet decisive that emptiness and dependent arising are complementary. Okay? So we can have an infallible inferential understanding of emptiness, that is a realization of emptiness, but we haven't yet completed our analysis of the correct view. Yeah, because we are not yet decisive that emptiness and dependent arising are complementary. Yeah, so it's not just the analysis of emptiness that gives us the full understanding of emptiness. It's when we come out of that, and it looks like it's an inferential, not a direct realization. We come out of that, and then we realize dependent arising and emptiness are complementary. How do we practice the path pleasing the Buddha? By using dependent arising as the reason to prove emptiness, we investigate the nature of reality and conclude that no objectifiable basis exists for any phenomena. When we search for what the real referent of a term, such as I, is, we cannot identify anything that is it. Isn't that mind-blowing? We can't identify that anything that is it, but we use the word all day in and all day out. And every word that we use, we can't identify anything that is that object. Yeah? I mean, we say, put the cup on the table, but we can't identify what the word cup really refers to or what the word table really refers to. Yeah? We can't identify what the cup is, what it really is, and what the table really is. Because as soon as we start analyzing, the whole thing dissolves. The whole thing falls apart. Yeah? And we search for what the real referent of a term, such as I, that's such a meaningful term, isn't it? We cannot identify anything that is it. No, that can't be. I can identify. I'm sitting here. Can't you see? I am here. What do you mean you can't identify anything that's me? I'm sitting here. What more do you want? Okay. I want true existence. Yeah. I want permanence, true existence, predictability, security. That's what I want. So pin it all down, and then nothing could change. Yeah? If we made everything predictable, everything consistent, everything secure, then nothing could change. But isn't that what we're all seeking? You know, don't we all want security and predictability and consistency? Now, this is what I keep hearing, you know, when we were working on the organizational chart, when we're reviewing the Abbey and, not necessarily what are we supposed to do with chaos in the world? Yeah. About chaos in the Abbey. But, yeah. So we want the opposite of that. But as soon as you have things that change, you're going to lose your predictability and security. Yeah. But in another way, if things were pinned down and they didn't change, then we could never become enlightened. So there's a trade-off here. If we want enlightenment, we have to give up predictability and security. And then our mind says, but enlightenment's supposed to be the ultimate predictability and security. Well, it is, because we've given up grasping at it.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that why that's the very first of the six
impermanence?
Yeah. Stability and security in a world where there's absolutely no such thing.
Right. Yeah. Right. And we suffer because we're wanting, a non-existent. Yeah. Can't you make this place stable, consistent, predictable? I don't like changing on a dime when I have a plan for the day.
Then we'd complain because it would be boring.
What?
Then we'd complain because it would be boring.
Yeah, exactly. It would be boring. So, yeah, then we complain about that. Exactly. So interesting. Okay. So how do we practice the path pleasing to the Buddha? By using dependent arising as the reason to prove emptiness, we investigate the nature of reality and conclude that no objectifiable basis exists for any phenomena. But you just told me there was the basis of designation, and now you're telling me there's no objectifiable basis? So there's a difference between an objectifiable basis and a basis of designation. Yeah, an objectifiable basis you have to be able to pinpoint when you search for it with ultimate analysis. A regular old basis of designation, that you don't have that requirement. It's just everybody kind of has to generally know what you're talking about. That's basically it, you know? You're never going to really pin it down. By understanding dependent arising well, we do not posit any notion of inherent existence. When this notion of an objectifiable basis has been dismantled, we correctly understand emptiness and are on the right path. So finding nothing is how you get on the right path. Yeah? When you search and can't find anything, you're on the right path. But that doesn't mean when you search your bank account and can't find anything, you're on the right path. You're on the wrong path then. Okay. This inferential realization destroys all false perceptions of their inherent existence, in that we now know for certain that inherent existence cannot possibly exist. However, we have not yet destroyed all false perceptions of their inherent existence in terms of uprooting the ignorance grasping at inherent existence. Okay? So we've destroyed all false perceptions of their inherent existence in the sense that we now know for certain that inherent existence can't exist. But we haven't yet destroyed all false perceptions of their inherent existence in the sense of we haven't uprooted all the ignorance grasping at inherent existence so that it can never return. Okay, so again, two meanings for the phrase destroy all false perceptions of inherent existence. The process of doing that begins only when we directly perceive emptiness without the medium of the conceptual appearance that an inferential realization entails. Okay, so we need the direct perception. Then, appearances are infallible dependent arisings. Emptiness is free of assertions of inherent existence or non-existence. As long as these two understandings are seen as separate, one has not yet realized the intent of the Buddha. Okay? So those two things, that appearances are infallible dependent arising And emptiness is free of assertions of inherent existence or non-existence. As long as those two things we can't put together and understand them together, then we haven't yet realized the intent of the Buddha. So we may have entered the path pleasing to the Buddha, but we haven't yet realized the intent of the Buddha. Realizing emptiness inferentially is an excellent first step. However, at this point, we have not equated emptiness and dependent arising. And here, dependent arising means appearances in the verse, okay? And cannot yet see them as compatible. The full understanding of emptiness cannot arise until we understand emptiness and dependent arising as complementary. Without understanding that the existence and identity of everything is posited purely in terms of dependence, we are compelled to assert that they exist from their own side. And that's what the lower schools do. Because they can't put emptiness and dependent arising together, so they say there's got to be inherent existence or existence from their own side. Because these schools accept some type of inherent existence, they believe that because phenomena exist dependently, they must exist inherently. So they're not only, you know, not seeing the compatibility, but they're seeing the opposite, which is that for things to be dependent arising, they have to inherently exist. Yeah, that's what the lower schools say. Why? Because if they didn't have something that was their inherent nature, then they wouldn't be anything at all. There would be total non-existence. And if things did not have something that made them what they are, then, you know, our language would be completely crazy. We could call anything anything, and just by our labeling it something, it could do that function because it would have nothing in it that made it capable of doing that function. If things, you know, so they have to be inherently existent, the lower schools say. From the Svatantrika Madhyamaka on down, they have not realized the intent of the Buddha. Okay? When he taught the nature of reality, and they are not able to gain an inferential realization of emptiness, let alone enter into the Arya's meditative equipoise, directly realizing emptiness. So these people, you know, yeah, we tend to sometimes look at people in the lower schools and, oh, they're such dum-dums. They believe in inherent existence. Why don't they know better? We're a great prasangi because we don't believe in inherent existence, do we? We believe in the emptiness of inherent, right? Yeah? We're not like those dum-dum vaibhashikas. Yeah? No, we're arrogant. The vaibhashikas are humble. Yeah, that shows how much understanding we have of emptiness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, doesn't it? Okay, so these people who make those assertions, remember Geshe Sonam Rinchen, you know, always saying, they weren't a bunch of dum-dums, you know, they were intelligent, thoughtful people who had reasons for asserting what they assert. Yeah. And if you don't agree with them, you have to be able to refute their reasons. But sometimes when you think about their reasons, they make sense. Yeah? Because it does make sense, doesn't it? If there wasn't something, yeah, that really made this a microphone, then, you know, why isn't it a pumpkin? Hey, maybe that's what happened with Cinderella. You know? What was it?
She thought it was a carriage.
It was a carriage that turned into a pumpkin, huh?
Vice versa.
A pumpkin that turned into a carriage. How did that happen? And then turned back into the... So what made it turn into the carriage?
Magic.
Magic.
The fairy.
Fairy godmother.
godmother.
Oh, there was a fairy godmother.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the fairy godmother was the fourth Diana. Yeah. Or, you know, or actually the Prasangikas, I think, say you can get it with the first Diana, you know. This is not a fairy godmother. Yeah. We busted the fairy godmother. Yeah. She's actually very predictable, if you understand that kind of stuff. Yeah? I mean, really, when you have those kind of powers, then those powers are not magic to you at all, because you completely understand how they work and you can make them work, and there's no problem. But for people who cannot describe the dependent arising of something, then we call that magic. That's what magic is, when we don't know the dependent arising process. There is a story about a monk who, when searching for just what the word I referred to, grabbed his donga in fear because he thought he was disappearing into total nothingness. So this reminds me of a man from Bihar, India, whom I ordained. One day we were discussing anatma, selflessness, and he became very agitated. Trembling, he said, "If there is no self, then nothing exists." I explained to him, this is His Holiness, I explained to him that on one side phenomena are empty, but on the other side they exist dependently. He calmed down and gradually understood the real meaning of anatma. Such fear may arise at this point in the process of gaining the correct view, when we are actually negating the true existence of the I and are about to gain a correct conceptual realization. You're about to gain it. Yeah? A correct conceptual realization of emptiness. This fear is due to the person thinking that because I cannot be found, the I is totally non-existent and is a result of confusing emptiness with total non-existence. Such confusion arises because the person has not yet seen that emptiness and dependent arising come to the same point. He cannot yet correctly establish the nominal or conventional existence of the I. Okay? So why does that fear arise? You know, you've understood emptiness, but we haven't been able to differentiate emptiness from total non-existence. Yeah. And we haven't yet been able to see that emptiness and dependent arising come to the same point, because we cannot yet establish that things can be empty and conventionally existent, which means dependently existent. Yeah, so our understanding is not complete. It's kind of wobbly still. So this is right before you gain the inferential understanding. So I am gaining not an inferential understanding, but, maybe it's inferential. So we're going to stop here. Okay, so we'll come back to this next week. We still have one verse more?
Which volume is that?
Two verses. Which
volume?
I don't even know the number of this volume yet. This is many chapters ahead. Yeah.
Question on that?
Uh-huh.
Someone says, what gets enlightened then?
Yeah. The I that is the mere I that is solely an appearance that cannot be found when analyzed. Yeah, the mere I gets enlightened. The mere I is the one that's in samsara. It's not that there's an inherently existent I in samsara, and we destroy that I, and then, you know, we get a new I that is enlightened. Yeah, the I that's in samsara also doesn't inherently exist. It also exists by being merely designated, just as the I that gets enlightened and the I that is enlightened. Okay? But you can't find any of these I's when you search for them with ultimate analysis, trying to find out what does that word really refer to. Okay? So it's the whole idea is that things can still exist even though they don't inherently exist. Yeah, like we can look at the cup and we can search and take it apart and put all the pieces and all the atoms and everything there, and we're not going to find any cup whatsoever. There is no cup there. But when we don't analyze, we can use the cup to drink water. You can also use it when you do analyze. It's not like it just, you know, it becomes non-existent when you analyze it. But we don't understand its conventional existence after we, you know, usually when we analyze it. That's why we have to see emptiness dawning as the meaning of dependent arising, and dependent arising dawning as the meaning of emptiness.
So I had a thought about cause and effect and nirvana. Mm-hmm. And I was actually thinking of phrasing a question similar in the context of this last question. So the mere eye mm-hmm. has the Buddha potential and becomes a Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
And yet is still an impermanent phenomena.
The mere eye, yeah.
Yeah, and is still changing and can still cause effects.
Yeah.
So in that sense, a being could be in nirvana and still there's cause and effect.
Oh, yeah.
And so although nirvana is permanent, mm-hmm. beings that are in nirvana
are impermanent,
have cause and effect. So in that sense, samsara and nirvana or samsara and beyond has cause and effect. It doesn't have to apply to nirvana itself, but those that are reached
in nirvana. Yeah, if you want to make that explanation. Yeah. Yeah. That would be another way to do it. Yeah. Because it isn't like you realize nirvana and then you become permanent.
No, and the Buddha has enlightened activity that causes beneficial effects.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Nobody said that a Buddha is permanent. Yeah. Now tell that to Jeffrey on Tuesday.
Somebody said that.
Yeah. Because the next section we go into is the true truths.